we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
You know, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices. Today, August 5th, Friday. Thank God it's Friday. Today in the studio, we have Steph.
Hey.
It's her first time on the show.
Welcome to the show, Steph.
Welcome to the show. Tell us a bit about yourself. How come you're on the show today? What's your journey leading up to this point?
Oh, goodness. So I got involved in animal rights about 4 years ago. Actually watching Sharkwater, really feeling like I needed to do something to help sharks and raise awareness about shark finning. So I looked into Sea Shepherd, got into Sea Shepherd, started going to City Hall meetings, trying to get shark fins banned, and just really becoming aware of local events and local organizations. And from there, got involved with VADL, Vancouver Animal Defense League, and their shark fin campaigns.
Yeah, that wasn't even that long ago, eh?
No, we got restaurants to drop shark fins around the city, quite a few, so that was really successful, as well as their anti-fur campaigns. And of course, Sea Shepherd, I've been quite involved with outreach and fundraising.
And I understand that you are sort of getting involved creatively for animal rights. Tell us a bit more about that.
I assume you're talking about All Our Bodies?
Yes, I am.
I just joined the All Our Bodies team, which is a zine curated by members of the Queer Animal Collective. And what it is a collection of stories and art and poetry that is telling the stories of queer, trans femme, racialized animals, and just otherwise marginalized groups. So that is a zine that you can pick up at various street libraries around Vancouver, Spartacus Books. You can also order yours at allourbodies.wordpress.com. And like and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook for updates.
Nice. I definitely will. Well, today's show is all about animals in university education or any other post-secondary education. I myself have had quite a bit of experience in post-secondary institutions and do have a few stories about how animal rights has been taught, but also how animal rights has been perceived in general and the reactions from my peers. Essentially, what I've been noticing is that there is a dissonance between learning and then actually doing. So one thing is to talk and theorize about a subject. Another thing is to do and act from what you've been learning. And I think it also ties in with how institutionalized and profitable our education system has become, because unfortunately, learning has become more about, you know, fitting into the system and getting all your credits right rather than pursuing a kind of activist interest in something that could materially help, for example, animals or other marginalized groups. Steph, I went to your grad show, and
yes, you
this
did.
Was at Kwantlen University, but it was downtown, and I noticed that I was first of all looking forward to vegan buffet, because that's sort of what the idea you gave me is that you convinced your classmates to leave animals off the menu for your grad show, but that didn't happen, did it?
That did not happen, unfortunately. So I had really, really tried to push for a vegan grad, not only because I feel like one night a week, like, we do not need other people's bodies on our plate. Let's just celebrate without that.
Try to tell that to some people.
Right?
Right. Just one meal. So not only was that kind of my angle, but also just the fact that I was part of a program that really pushed the environmental implications of design and product design specifically is what I was studying. And I felt like we all, you know, say that we care so much about the environment and the impact that we're having, yet why can't we acknowledge the environmental impact that eating animals is having? So I felt that it was really important for us to to kind of walk the talk and to have a vegan Groucho. And I really at first thought that that is what was going to happen, and people seemed really on board, and I kind of just let it go. And there was a separate kind of committee of students that were taking care of the ordering of the food, and it just came down to them making the decision that there, quote unquote, had to be something for everybody.
Right.
And a funny story is that the first thing to go were the vegan falafels, and the last thing to stay was the meat and cheese. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because I've taken a bunch of, you know, environmental classes, particularly in the field of philosophy. And again, people like to talk about it and theorize about it. But I brought up, for example, the fact that we were talking, I can't remember the specific context, but I brought up this idea that it's possible to feed canines, so our companion dogs, actually plant-based diets, and that it's actually a lot healthier for them too, depending, of course, what you feed them, but that it's possible. And a reaction I got back was, well, but the dogs want to eat meat. Mm. And I just said back, you know, well, the dog wants to eat my shoe as well. Am I going to feed them my shoe? No, obviously I'm going to do what's best for my dog. And if that would mean feeding them animals, then that's one thing, but it doesn't necessarily. So there, I have actually found even within the most radical communities and most radical classes that there has been a resistance from students who would otherwise have very liberal opinions. And so that's kind of been at the same time disheartening, but also eye-opening in the sense that how our education works, how our education is structured. And it's also given me an idea, a sense that animal rights within institutionalized education is, it's very difficult to find an actual place for that because mm-hmm. what you do after class is thought of so little, unfortunately. Stay tuned. Our show will be all about animals in education, and we have some great interviews coming up. And do give us feedback if you have experiences of your own.
Can I talk about my experience?
Of course,
please,
Allison.
Do.
But there, as I mentioned to you before, Beck, you know, I was thinking back when you were asking this question earlier this week about what our experiences were, and I applaud you, Steph, for doing that. I'm curious, was it a large grad class? Like, how much
no.
are we talking here? Smaller? More?
10 people.
Oh, that's it. Okay, so yeah, I was just thinking that's a really bold step to make to bring that. And then what was the what were you graduating in? I'm just sort of.
So I graduated with a degree in product design.
Okay, so it's not related at all to animal rights.
Not
okay.
related, okay. but the program itself yeah. really focused on sustainability and building okay. products that were not going to be so damaging to the earth that, you mm-hmm. know, the previous products and the consumerist lifestyle is having on the earth.
So you would think that the awareness would be there among your...
There definitely is awareness. Yeah. And I actually, during my 4 years, one girl in my class went vegan. I encouraged another young man to give up farm salmon, which is, you know, small victory. And totally. The people generally do have a very open-mindedness to environmental issues and global issues, including the environmental impact that eating animals has. For some reason, when it comes right down to actions and... There seemed to be a bit of a resistance there, but I think that, you know, overall they are very open-minded, and also just who I am and who they got, you know, 10 people. It's a very intimate setting. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
me saying I wanted a vegan grad show wasn't new news.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. I just wanted to get some kind of context because I was thinking back. I went to school many, many years ago as I was telling Beck. I'm really old, back in the 1990s. And no opportunities like that really came up for me. That was when I was going to university. So you know, you didn't really know your classmates in that. I went to BCIT after that. We had a smaller grad class, 40 people, but still not the intimate small, like 10 people. It's like you're making up 1/10 of everyone, mm-hmm. right? So that's awesome. But yeah, when Beck asked that question, you know, animal rights, well, I mentioned to both of you, I don't think veganism even existed back then.
Totally.
As part of our culture, as part of, like, now you're hearing 1 out of 10 university students in British Columbia are vegan, and
wow.
maybe more than that, actually. And actually, I'm reading stats that are even more than that young university students, they are going vegan, and I'm seeing it. I still live and work at the University of British Columbia, so I'm very much in that academic environment all the time. But yeah, I'm just, back then that didn't exist. I used to be part of the UBC Student Environment Center, you know, we were vegetarians, we weren't vegans. I used to be part of, I don't know, do you know what culture jamming is?
No.
Yeah, it's too dated for you guys. You should look it up. You would both be in it. It's pretty radical. So we used to do things that I can't speak about on the air because I will get arrested. I'm still worried about that. But one of the things we did do that I can speak about, I do remember, is protesting in front of the McDonald's in the University Village, which is like right a block on. From where I live. And we were playing on probably a VHS tape and a big cathode ray tube television, the episode from The Simpsons when Lisa goes vegetarian.
Amazing.
So that was, and we were, oh, and then I made up, I don't know, I have posted this on my Facebook. I found this design that I had made. We were handing out free coupons for a free Big Mac, and it totally looked like it was free Big Mac. But then in small writing, it had like all the disastrous impacts that your Big Mac has on people, the environment, and animals.
Yeah. Cool.
It's pretty awesome because people were totally taking them. They thought they got a free Big Mac. So,
yes.
And I made those, I found those. So, that's
amazing.
My experience.
That's awesome. And now our segment on upcoming animal-related events.
Tomorrow, August 6th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., is the weekly chicken vigil on the northeast corner of Commercial and Hastings. It's a peaceful event of bearing witness at the Hallmark Chicken Slaughterhouse, and many of you might not know that there's even a slaughterhouse there, so it's a lot of it is about raising awareness, and it's actually a great vigil to go to if you have time. August 10th, from 6 to 8 p.m., there is a workshop on easy vegan Indian food led by The Flying Abneet. It is at Britannia Community Center, and it's $25 for what she calls a belly full of warm goodness, tips for healthier meal planning, and exclusive recipes from the chef herself.
On August 14th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Sea Shepherd Conservation Society is hosting a beach cleanup at Lighthouse Park in West Vancouver. So come out, come support our oceans and clean up our beaches. This is something that's done every few months, so if you miss this one, there will be more, but the weather will not be this good for long.
Good point. Another Sea Shepherds event is on August 25th from 8 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. Sea Shepherds is screening Sonic Sea at Eternal Abundance on Commercial Drive. The theme of this movie are the devastating impacts of industrial and military ocean noise on whales and other marine life. And I'm excited to go to that screening. It sounds amazing. I'm always impressed how Eternal Abundance cleans up their space for events.
Fits
I'm
so
like,
many people in that
so
space.
So many people. I'm like, wow. And if you have any animal-related events, you can email us at animalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. Joining us for our first interview is Associate Emily Carr Professor and artist Julie Andreev. Apart from teaching, Julie is an artist, vegan, researcher, and educator. Julie is the co-founder of the relational art group Vegan Congress that holds events intended to develop awareness and compassion for non-human beings at Emily Carr University here in Vancouver. Hi, Julie, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Beck. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Could you speak a bit about the beginnings of Vegan Congress, how it emerged, and what its function is within Emily Carr?
Sure. Yeah, we're a group of, actually we started as just a group of, you know, half a dozen faculty, staff, and students at Emily Carr in 2013 that wanted to get together and create some events to draw attention to compassion and vegan practice at the university. And since that time, we've actually grown to include other faculty and students and staff from other universities. So currently we have people from Simon Fraser University, Emily Carr, and UBC. And most of the events that we've been holding have to do with something about food or clothes. And, you know, our group is made up of people who really love food and love animals. And so in a sense, they're all great cooks and they're very kind people. And so we try to blend, you know, this kind of skills that each of the people offer in the Vegan Congress to hold these workshops or sort of information sessions or more experimental kinds of events at the school.
Do you have an example of one of your events that you held like maybe in the last year or so?
Sure. We held a string of events, actually. One of them in 2015, one of them was the most popular one, I guess, was called the Vegan Tea Party. And this one was kind of like a Mad Hatter's sort of tea party where we had all kinds of vegan treats to eat and little snacks and great tea and, you know, like miso soup and
yum.
Had Jesse Spott as doing a little VJ kind of thing, and people loved it. So that's sort of become our signature event that we hold every year.
Mm-hmm.
I should just mention that we're starting a reading group, a vegan reading group that's been initiated by Ella at SFU, who will be leading the group in the fall. So other things we've done are sort of little exhibitions where we have people come in and participate by having their photograph taken and speaking about their relationship to animals.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. It's quite varied what we do.
And for our listeners who want to get involved, just hang on till the end of the interview and we'll ask Julie how to get involved and the specifics around that. Julie, I've been doing a bit of research on the Vegan Congress, and I see that you call yourselves a relational art collective. Could you define the concept or idea of relational art and also the importance of human relations and their social context in regards to creating art?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. The idea of relational art is characterized, it's a kind of art making that's characterized by events that bring people together. So there's usually a theme or a situation that's presented by an artist or a group. And these events become opportunities for dialogue. So they might also be opportunities for people to participate and actually generate content for an exhibition. So, for instance, we had as I mentioned, we had this exhibition called How Vegan Are You? And it was a photo booth, and people could come in and have their photograph taken, and also we would annotate their response to that question, how vegan are you? And then it became the responses with these photographs of individuals in the community became a slideshow that then was part of an exhibition. So relational art is really about bringing people together in order to create dialogue. And how this operates in a social context is to generate, I guess, ultimately social change.
And continuing along that line, let's talk a bit about your current PhD research at SFU. Could you elaborate a bit on your current thesis and also explain what you mean by biophilic ethics and also relational caring?
Yeah, well, the sort of loose title that I'm working with right now for the PhD research that I'm doing at SFU in graduate liberal studies, the title is Biophilic Ethics and Creativity with More Than Human Being. And this is a development of the term biophilia, which was first used by Eric Fromm, the psychologist, that relates of being attracted to all that is alive and vital. Then the biologist Edward Wilson in 1984 used the term to suggest that the connections that human beings subconsciously seek out with the rest of life is an important aspect of human existence. I've sort of taken up this idea of biophilia, and I'm expanding on it to propose that more connections can happen with other beings through our day-to-day activities, because as we know, historically, humans have spent less and less time engaging with biophilic activities, such as, you know, connecting with other beings, with natural systems, and with the natural world around us. My research is looking into how art and other creative practices can offer methods for reconnecting. So primarily I'm looking at interspecies creativities, like making art with other beings. Mm-hmm. And of course this happens with, you know, taking into account an ethics of care, so a respectful, caring, and informed approach to making art with animals and plants. If one thinks about it, animals and plants are themselves creative beings, and if you take the time to notice, you can see how they are constantly creating novel and expressive responses in their own day-to-day lives.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for many years with my two dogs, creating videos and interactive projects. But recently I've been expanding to work with salmon, trees, and most recently with crows to see how creative they are in our nearby vicinity. And this has led to a kind of project that I'm exploring in specifically in my dissertation, which is a composition that a crow and myself will be creating for a sound performance.
Wow, that sounds so interesting. It just reminded me of, it was this little news story that popped up about, you know, something like a 10-year-old girl who would put out food for a crow, and the crow would bring her little gifts, like shiny yeah. little plastic things that looked special to the crow, and she collected them and has this, you know, big collection of just random little, you know, what are essentially garbage objects, but to the crow, they're so special, and the crow, you know, formed this connection to this little girl. I don't know if you've heard of that story, but it sort of fits into that idea of connecting with the creative side of animals, too.
That is definitely, I know about the story, and I also think that that's a great example on about more than human creativity. And I should just point out that I'm having a similar experience with a crow family that lives just around, you know, around my house here, and they recently had two babies, and so we're having a lot of fun together, and one of the most recent things that the male crow brought to me, I believe in a gesture of thank you for some peanuts that I'd left for him, is a piece of beach glass. And I can, you know, it just makes me think about how the crow must have had this idea to go and seek something out, or he found something and held within that, you know, that object, the idea to bring it back and actually gift it. So this little piece of beach glass is just one of my most precious things I have right now.
Wow. Who would have thought, right?
Yeah.
That's amazing. So on to our next question. How do you see the inclusion of animal issues within institutional education, for example, at Emily Carr? And also, would you say that Vegan Congress is a type of reaction to actually create space for dialogue on animal ethics?
Well, definitely, in response to the second part of your question, definitely the Vegan Congress has created a dialogue on animal ethics. And I'm just going to give you a very practical example of that, is that the Vegan Congress last year held a reading of what we called a compassion manifesto. And we held it as a kind of a relational art event that generated some discussion on animals and how they may be used as resources in art and design practices. And when I say resource, I'm being critical. So that event that we hold was directly responsible for then the university creating an initiative to generate a policy and a set of procedures on animal involvement in art. And this policy and procedures is currently a work in progress, but we're the plan is to actually put it in place by the end of the fall or the spring. And I should just point out that, you know, there are policies for animals involvement, as we know, in, you know, the medical testing industries and and so on, which is quite a tragic, you know, tragic involvement of animals. Mm-hmm. But what is not known is that animals also become involved in other practices, such as art. And these practices don't generally have policies in place in universities for ethical conduct. So what we're looking at is providing a code of practice that considers respect and care as the basis for any engagement with non-human animals.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And manifesto, especially at an art school, is a great place to start for kind of policy change, right?
It is, exactly. And while it began as a sort of a gesture to, you know, previous art movements manifestos, it's actually generated real significant, you know, change within the university itself. And I should just point out that that manifesto is going to be part of the forthcoming book chapter for a book called New Critical Perspectives on Veganism. And it's being edited by Jody Castor-Cano and Rasmus Simonsen. And that's coming out probably this fall.
Wow, I can't wait to read it. We should do another show on that.
Sure.
And lastly, for anyone who's interested, how would one get involved with Vegan Congress at Emily Carr?
Yeah, well, we're always looking for, you know, enthusiastic people. So if you're interested, you can send an email to vegancongress@gmail.com. And, you know, we'll see how you want to become involved. But yeah, everybody's welcome.
Great. And are you speaking to students or also the public?
Definitely to anyone who wants to get involved. We've had a lot of great response from people who come in, you know, that aren't affiliated with the university. All our events are public. And so we're not intending to just be an exclusive group.
Awesome. And you mentioned a reading series earlier. Could you give a few details on that, or will you be posting that online or on social media?
Yeah, we'll once we get some dates settled, we'll definitely be posting it on our Facebook page and also on our website, which is vegancongress.org. And you can look us up on Facebook. It's just Vegan Congress. And that's going to be probably focusing on ethics of care readings and ecofeminism and, you know, critical veganism and things that are affiliated, such as, you know, ecological philosophy and so on.
Great. Wow. Thank you so much, Julie, for your time, for your insight, and for joining us here at Animal Voices on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio Vancouver.
And now for our segment on animal-related news stories.
Does this news story sound familiar to you? A 21-year-old gorilla dies suddenly Friday night, supposedly leaving staff in shock. This was at a zoo in Montreal. Gorillas can live up to 40 years, yet this one died suddenly at 21 years. His name was Nasabi. The zoo is already speculating on whether or not to replace him. He was one of three total gorillas at this zoo, which is called Granby Zoo in Montreal. And it's just amazing to me how animals, especially animals like a gorilla who are in captivity, are considered loved and respected and cherished by the zoo when they're directly profiting from illegal trades and making money from essentially letting this intelligent animal live its life in captivity. And always when the animal dies, because it is always, because animals always die in enclosures.
I don't know why we're still surprised about this.
Right. Every news story that comes out, a new animal dies in a zoo, and this, essentially we should be expecting that, right? It's just amazing to me, the language that is used, the loving kind of compassionate language that is used around these zoos who are not sanctuaries. They are not refuges for animals. They are zoos, which by definition, they're a corporation. Steph, what's your news story today?
So I wanted to talk a bit about caribou, actually, and the plight of the caribou in Canada, specifically Alberta. Although there's only three provinces where caribou aren't at risk of extinction, but Alberta actually just released a new draft plan for, I guess, their efforts to save the populations. And while it does take steps towards restoration of their habitats, which, I mean, caribou need old growth, they need large habitats, they need habitats that aren't being disrupted by industry. So while there are a few steps being taken, it doesn't really address the problem, which is industry coming in to these habitats and pushing out the caribou. Logging, oil, gas, really the government is allowing them to keep coming in and destroying. And what the government is saying that we need predator control.
Right.
We need to slaughter the wolves, which are hunting the caribou. And we need to put in permanent enclosures.
Right.
Which is essentially just a zoo for wildlife. And I think these efforts shouldn't be applauded. They need to be booed. It's really to put in a permanent enclosure in a wild landscape to keep the caribou and their habitat from being violated by industry is really just a representation of our just utter failure to effectively manage ecosystems and keep them healthy enough to support life. I mean, we're one of 30 million species, and yet we demand 90% of the land on this earth.
And unfortunately, other wildlife, like the wolf, as you mentioned, become the scapegoat.
Scapegoat, for, absolutely.
These larger industries to continue to exist. Thanks, Steph, for that story. I wholeheartedly agree with your opinion. Canada's only shark derby starts in Nova Scotia this weekend.
What's a shark derby?
Let me tell you, Allison, what a shark derby is. It is essentially a fishing tournament where hundreds of anglers pay to see who can catch the biggest shark. It's my understanding that only endangered sharks are released, but that all the other sharks are just taken out of the ocean and put in this competition. And there was a quote from one of the participants in this news article that I read, and it goes as follows: "Just to feel it, even if it's a little one, you've got something there that's very powerful," talking about a shark. And it just highlights the idea of, you know, possession. And, I really do wonder how many women are going to participate in this, because it's a very kind of masculine and patriarchal expression of, you know, domination and who has the biggest. Really, like, how many women are going to have fun there? And
how anyone can have fun there is beyond me.
But. Right, right. So that was our news. Thanks for listening. Joining us for a feature interview is historian and professor Nicolas Rupke, who teaches history of science at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. Without further ado, let's get our discussion started right away. For our listeners who don't know, Nico is actually my dad. I can finally say welcome to the show.
Well, I'm delighted to join you, Beck.
All right. So as I understand it, you're spearheading a new course this fall titled Animal Experimentation and Animal Rights in Historical Perspective. What exactly are your students expected to learn in this class?
Well, like in all classes, of course, they have to learn lots of facts and dates. They need to be given information. But what I want especially from my students is that on such an important, almost delicate and certainly hot topic as animal rights, they develop a certain historical literacy so that they can talk not just simplistically, but with background, a rich source of information. And the way I do that is that I give them some general lectures, but that each of them gets a topic assigned to them, and I say, you become the class expert, you become the campus expert, you become your family expert on an issue of your choice, which can be a person. So I say to one, you become the expert on Peter Singer. The other becomes the expert on an historical figure, such as Anna Kingsford.
Or Lizzie Lind of Hugby.
Exactly. And I always try to relate it to their existing expertise. So if there is a musical person from the music department, I had these ones, I say you become the expert on Richard Wagner, who, believe it or not, was a passionate animal rights person. I cater to their interests. I link to their knowledge. And I make them literate in arguing for their line, which I do not force on them, of course, they develop knowledge and ability to argue from that knowledge.
Mm-hmm. In 1990, so quite a while ago, you published a book called Vivisection in Historical Perspective. Can you elaborate a bit on how attitudes towards animals, specifically from an institutional perspective, have changed since you wrote that book 26 years ago?
Oh, yes, I can. I remember very well. You see, my book was sort of a product of the 1980s. And in the 1980s, the situation was quite different from now. At the time, I was in Britain, and I tell you, boy, animal rights had entered the university through student protests, not so much through teaching or anything, through student protests. That was the animal liberation activism of the time. And this was highly emotional. extremely public, and it was in that context that I wrote that book. Now, since then, perhaps sadly, I should say, the activism has somewhat abated. Students, certainly in my university, but I'd say across North America and Europe, are far less involved, at least not in the form of activism. Less, I should say, not totally, of course. You know, there is no total passivity. Of course, there is a lot going on, but not like it was then. And I remember that I wrote this book while I was at the Wellcome Institute for the History of Medicine in London. And because of animal activism, I had to wear a badge to be checked by the security guards, making sure I wasn't someone who was going to do damage inside the building. Right. Nevertheless, we did damage, but to, let's say, animal experimentation practices of the Wellcome Pharmaceutical Company by writing this book. Mm. But now, what do we have now? Well, you know, it relates to other issues. I think animal rights, it relates to other issues. In the 80s, it still came from 60s issues that had to do with post-colonialism, with the first new feminist wave, perhaps even the second. Whereas today, there are other issues, very important.
Right. And a lot of it probably also has to do with the fact that, you know, university education has become so, you know, has become essentially a business. And so you see in general a lot less activism. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Yeah, I think in the 80s, certainly 70s and 60s, there was among students less a concern of, will I get a job, you know? Keep your nose clean, behave, quote-unquote, please the establishment and you'll do all right. No, there was an enormous amount of idealistic activism, which today has rather declined, I'm sad to say. Mm-hmm. So, and that has to do also indeed to the increase of corporatism. So the issue has become less even than it was in the 60s and 70s. Science departments, medical research departments, mistreating animals, it has become increasingly now much larger, the colossal food industry.
So your research and expertise sort of centers around how science has participated in defining the social role of non-human animals. So relating to that, could you give some examples of how these attitudes have rippled into everyday culture and society?
This is absolutely fascinating. Yes, of course. Well, I deal with science, the history of science, and that approach to the issue of animal rights. And you can see that in the history of science, science dealt with animals earlier on. Gosh, let's just deal simply with some of the higher animals on the evolutionary ladder, the non-human primates. And in the 19th century, it was man who went out, you know, overseas, so to speak, from Europe, overseas, imperially, and developing colonies and confronting also these big apes, capturing them, killing them, stuffing them, putting them in museums. That's an interesting aspect of attitudes towards animals in the 19th century. But then through the 20th century, especially after World War II, what do we see? Women enter science, and women develop a very different approach to the study of primates, non-human primates. You know, let me just cite, you will have heard of them. The great Jane Goodall, the great Diane Fossey, the great Baruti Galdikas, if I pronounce her name correctly, sorry. You know, one from Britain, one from America, and one who lives in Canada, I believe. One a chimp expert, one a gorilla expert, the other a chimp expert. And what did they do when they studied these animals? Did they confront them and kill and capture and take and stuff? No. Mm-hmm. They showed a kind of familiar empathy, and they integrated in their society in the wild and studied them that way. This is a fantastic new development towards animals that helps us understand animals as sentient, feeling creatures, perhaps really rather much closer to us than we were made to believe by these Victorian conquerors who said beasts whom we confronted and killed and conquered. Mm-hmm. Huh? It's fantastic to see this happen. And now the man primatologists, the male primatologists among us, are following this work. You know, I only have to mention to you Frans de Waal. You know, he's really following this and looking at the female element also in primate society, such as his bonobos. Huh? So you see how, if you look at the scientific approach to animals, things have changed from animals being those adversaries out there to be conquered, to being fellow sentient creatures to be empathized with. Mm-hmm. And this is becoming an important feature today in science contributing to that. Increasingly, science is discovering that there is a great deal of human-like feeling, perhaps even some cognition, among a variety of species.
And maybe at this point we can get into a few more specifics. So who are some of the early advocates of animal rights? What were their motivations? Can you speak a bit to how they organized and promoted the cause?
Yeah, of course. Yes, we have our heroes. Now, they exist in different fields. Huh? I think perhaps the best known heroes of the past are the philosophers of animal rights. So we have the Brit Jeremy Bentham, late 18th century, early 19th. And Bentham, of course, was the man who introduced in philosophical thinking, in ethical thinking, this notion that we shouldn't judge animals by whether they can speak or reason, but whether they are sentient and can feel and suffer. And so that's an important criterion. Let me just mention another one, another great philosopher of about a century later, not from Britain but Germany, Leonard Nelson. Leonard Nelson was an ethicist who said, not like Bentham, you know, can they feel? He had another fascinating argument. He said, what if there is a higher civilization out in space that came to Earth, treated us like, you know, animals, took us for their laboratories, would we say, well, yeah, justified, they are higher than we are? Of course not. Mm-hmm. We would be horrified. We would oppose it. Yeah? And so there are these philosophical heroes of the movement. But then you mentioned organization. And of course, these guys didn't organize anything much. They were thinkers. The organization was largely driven by women in the 19th century who identified with animal mistreatment because they, their position, women's position in society, was also suffering under structures of oppression that had similarities with the oppression of animals, the mistreatment of animals, showing that feminism and animal rights have historically been intrinsically linked.
And leading from this point, could you
elaborate a bit on why it's important to have this historical analysis, specifically of the place of animals, in this case within Western society? How may this analysis benefit or enlighten animal advocacy today?
I like to answer that because, of course, my philosophy colleagues tend to be a bit conceited in university. They think that their philosophical arguments are always the most enlightening and important. But we historians say, easy, guys. We have a unique contribution to make to which you have no real intellectual access, and it is the following. When philosophers argue, you argue, of course, in terms of facts and reasoning, of rationality. Sadly, most people are not motivated by facts and rationality. These you use, we all use them, but people are motivated by values. And historians have uniquely access to that, can show this. For example, if you now had a TV debate between two philosophers for or against animal rights, one cannot say to the other, oh, you know, you say that because you are a Catholic. Or the other says, you say that because you are a Protestant. That's bad form. Mm-hmm. That's politically incorrect. But an historian not only can, but must say that. And you see that things like that, religious background, class background, values, these people become imbued through their upbringing, etc., their time and place, are essential in what sides they take. As I just said, women took the side of animals because of their place in society. So you see, as an historian, you can locate in place and time and then see what the driving forces, often the unspoken driving forces, are behind, for, or against. And that we always need to address because they are the most powerful cause of what happens in society.
And I'm sort of interested now in the student reactions after being exposed to this kind of material. Do you have any stories about that? Or how do you see the issue of animal rights in general fitting in or not fitting in into institutional research and teaching?
Well, the teaching of this in academe, in institutions, so to speak, it's delicate because when you deal with animal rights, you almost invariably are for it. So even offering a course in academe on animal rights means you are promoting animal rights. If you are against it, you just don't talk about it. Because, you know, all's well, don't talk about it.
Right.
You see what I mean? The food industry or the medical science industry, pharmaceutical industry, etc. Don't talk about it.
Right.
So not everybody dares to do that. Not everybody is in a position to do that.
Could you speak a bit to your research going forward and, in your opinion, how you see animal issues evolving within the historical and scientific discourses?
Yeah, difficult, you know, to predict always. Of course, much is going to be determined in the 20th century about genomics. You know, genes are going to be so important. And I'm sure that genetic similarities and analyses will enter the ethics also of animal rights if they haven't already done so. So I think that's a very big thing, but that's not my field, of course. My field in the history of science, what I'm already doing and very interested in also for the next years is that I'm looking at the connection between animal behavior and human morality. How human morality often is justified by animal behavior. I analyze that, but that, of course, also implies a commonality that confirms human rights on at least some animals, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. So the animal rights issue is profoundly involved in this commonality of behavioral, the causes of our behavior and the morality of it. So that's what I'm working on, and a number of other people. I think most directly, the hot stuff at the moment coming out is stuff by, you know, people such as Barbara King, if I may mention her name. But they emphasize that commonality of humans and animals in terms of feelings, not of rationality, not of cognitive abilities, but of feeling. Mm-hmm. And I think this is an exciting development that indicates women's leadership in primatology, or at least a major input of women in primatology today and in years to come.
All right, Nico, thank you so much for joining us on the show, for your illuminating research. And we from Animal Voices wish you all the best for your continuing important research.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm honored and delighted to be on the show and be one of the Animal Voices.
You've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show next Friday, August 12th at noon for a surprise show. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe via iTunes.
Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. We are an all-volunteer-run radio station and show, and we need help. If you are interested in producing or hosting shows or doing interviews, and you have good organizational skills and are familiar with the issues of animal advocacy and veganism, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We can use your help. And training will be provided.
You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. In honor of our feature interviewees' vivisection research, we're now closing the show with a song called Vivus Sectio, a song paying homage to animals in laboratories by animal activist Louise Dutoit. The chorus goes as follows. When yet another human comes to lock me in a cage, when I become the victim of his power and his rage, the only thing that keeps me sane is when I have faith that in the light of hope someday I will be safe. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, and thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
I become the victim of his power. arms and iron butts, with cables, chains and locks, where their heart now would between their white claws. They investigate my brain with cruelty and disdain, causing me excruciating pain. I don't have a name, and a puppet in a game returns the rules, but the torture stays the same. I watch them and I see Erdrus eyes staring at me, their empty souls with the signs to grieve. And yet another year comes to lock me in a cage.
Vancouver Co-op Radio is testing our transmitter facility from March 15th to April 4th. If you are experiencing...
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Hey kids, let's go out to the garage and make some new life forms. Get ready, because that's already happening. We'll talk with Pat Mooney, founder of the Etc. Group, about crazy new technology on the loose. Then well-known journalist Stephen Kotler takes us on a tour of eco-psychology in 10 easy steps. Is it a diversion for comfortable people in coffee shops, or is it the answer? I'm Mike Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Vancouver Co-op Radio is testing our transmitter facility from March 15th to April 4th. If you are experiencing interference in our broadcast, please call